Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts. Today we are delighted to be joined by chef and restaurateur Nathan Outlaw. Since 2011, Nathan has held two Michelin stars for his eponymous restaurant in Cornwall, the only fish restaurant in Britain to have been awarded two stars. In 2017, it was named Best Restaurant in Britain by the Good Food Guide. Nathan, welcome to Table Talk.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
So Nathan, you grew up in Kent. What was food like when you were little?
I was very fortunate. I mean, my father's a chef and still is working with me now. And so we always had good food. I mean, when I say good food, it wasn't posh food. It was wholesome food. So we always had things like stews and hot pots and, you know, nice roasts. And, you know, we always had a really good sort of buffet when we had parties and things like that, you know, with proper stuff on it. Both my sets of grandparents were keen gardeners. So I was always quite aware of, you know, sort of how things grew and how things come, you know, how that chip became a chip and things like that. So, yeah, I had a really good sort of upbringing.
And did your father encourage an interest in becoming a chef?
He did. Well, at first, I mean, I sort of said to him that I was interested in cooking, and I was always, whenever he was in the kitchen or at work, I'd go to work with him from about the age of eight, I suppose. I'd go on a Saturday morning, so I was always around and he'd sort of get me doing little jobs. But it wasn't until I was probably about 15, I did my proper work experience like you do when you're at school, and I said I want to do it. And then he did his utmost that summer just try and put me off. He didn't want me to do it. He said, it's just like you give up a lot, you know, it's antisocial and, you know, all them sort of things. And I just persevered and wanted to do it. And I think seeing my dad really enthusiastic and really proud about things when he'd made something, he'd be like, look at that, yeah, that's really good. And he knew it was good. And I thought, well, that's a nice way to be, you know. I sort of connected with that even when I was younger. And I thought, yeah, it's a nice thing to have that sort of satisfaction from what you've been cooking. But he did his utmost to try and stop me.
But he didn't succeed.
No, he didn't. No. Now he's working with me, so that's quite funny.
And did he cook much fish when you were younger?
No, because I actually didn't eat fish. I'd have fish and chips, and I'd have fish fingers and the fish cakes and things like that, and tuna sandwiches. But I would never touch fresh fish, and that was more because my mum doesn't eat fish at all. She still doesn't, although I try and force her to eat some because she's got it. But I think the interest in seafood came from family times at the seaside. You know, we spent every chance that we had as a family, when I say family, it'd be either mum and dad and me and my brother, the four of us, or my, you know, my grandparents and cousins and stuff, we go to the seaside. So it was more to do with, you know, that nostalgic going to something like Hastings, seeing the boats coming in, seeing the fish market. Well, it's not really a fish market, it's like fish stalls. And I was just interested from that. And then when I started cooking in London after I finished college, I just sort of gravitated towards seafood and towards the fish section of the kitchen, and I was really good at it. And I thought, you know what, well, if I'm going to do this properly and, you know, and sort of satisfy this interest, I've got to go to work for Rick Stein. You know, he was the best, you know, seafood chef in the world in my eyes.
And that's what took you to Cornwall then?
Yep, that was it. Yeah, I mean, we spent lots of family holidays in Cornwall, so Easters and summertimes camping or at campsites and, you know, in different holiday parks that there are down in the southwest. And I just thought, you know, when I'm old enough, when I'm big enough to leave home and I can, you know, and you do my own thing, I want to live in Cornwall. So, and that's, it worked out very well because there was also the best fish, you know, restaurant in the country at the time, the seafood restaurant there as well. So it sort of, yeah, it was perfect really for me.
And what is it about fish that you just love? I mean, why has it become your something you're so well known for?
I think from an actual chef point of view, I find it is a challenge, right? It's a big challenge because every seafood that I use, and we probably cook with about 35, 40 different species. And then when they're wild, they're all different. They're like human beings in terms of like every human being is different, every fish is different. So when you're writing a recipe or you're doing something in a restaurant where you say it takes 4 minutes, you can never get it perfectly right because they are all different. And whether the state of freshness, all those things really interested me, sort of like a bit of an anorak, a bit of a nerd about it, you know. So and then on top of that, when I worked at the seafood restaurant, I got a lot of exposure of the fishermen and the actual, like, the proper hardy fishermen that went out in all weather conditions. And I just thought, this is like a fascinating industry. These guys go out and do this fishing and, like, basically are risking their lives at sea for me to cook a piece of fish and put it in front of someone. So I just sort of needed a big respect. And I just, yeah, so the whole industry and fish just fascinates me.
And have you developed a close relationship with some of the fishermen in Cornwall?
Yeah, no, well, my wife is actually from Padstow, which is a big, you know, sort of a fishing port, a very historical fishing port. And her family have connections with fishing families and they all know them. So I was sort of like lucky enough to sort of socialise with fishermen when I was working at the seafood restaurant and still do to this day. When you're in an environment with people like that, it's just it's like quite humbling and good fun, and there's lots of stories and drinking, and it's just going to be, you know, you're going to have a good night when you're going out with the fishermen.
And what was it like working with Rick Stein? What did he teach you?
I think with Rick, it was like my idol. So it was sort of, I was a bit sort of nervous when I first started working for him. Every day we went in there, it was just such a busy restaurant. It was like you didn't have a chance to think for you. Yeah, you were just there and you were dedicated to it and working hard. And it was fun though. It wasn't a kitchen in that era in the industry in the sort of mid-90s, late 90s. It was quite, and it still can be, it's quite a hostile environment, kitchens, whereas Rick's wasn't. It was just fun and you were busy and you were just cooking all these wonderful dishes that he created from his travels around the world. And it was just a different thing because at the time, most restaurants were cooking French food, and if you weren't cooking posh French food, then you weren't considered a real chef, right? Which is total, you know, so I won't swear, but so yeah. And it's whereas regard, yeah, when I was to go and work with someone like Rick, it was just more an infectious sort of like influence on me in terms of where he traveled. You come back with these stories and you just sort of like, I suppose he's like a magpie, he went around the world catching, you know, nicking everybody's recipes. But when he brought them back, he sort of fused that Cornish produce and Cornish seafood with them ideas that he'd found from around the world, and that's very unique.
And has that inspired you to travel, to find out more things about different cuisines, how they treat fish and that kind of thing?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think I know a lot about what's in the Atlantic Ocean, but give me the Indian Ocean, give me the Pacific Ocean, it's a completely different world. And so as I sit here at, you know, 41 years old, I've still got all that to learn. So that's really exciting for me because I want to know what's in all these other places. And hopefully, you know, in the future, that's something that I'll do a lot more of and, you know, learn. Because every time you get away, I've got to a point now where I'm cooking, the cooking part is pretty straightforward. You know, I've been doing it for, you know, over 20 years. It's it's now I need to, you know, sort of be like what, you know, what I suppose what Rick was doing. You know, travel around and you pick up things. And when you're trying to do something in the UK and you're trying to be authentic, you can't be unless you've been to the place, I don't think, and understand how it's done. So I've got a long, long, long list of places I need to go. Yeah. And I might not get it all done, but I'll try to get as much as I can.
And what's it like setting up a restaurant? You first of all set up the Black Pig and then Restaurant Nathan Outlaw in Port Isaac. I mean, what have you learned from setting up restaurants?
A lot. And yeah, I've learned a lot from opening restaurants. I mean, I opened arguably, and against lots of advice, like people said to me when I was 24 when I opened my first restaurant. And
so young.
Yeah, it was super young. And then people were just like, what are you doing? I had a pretty good job in near Newbury, a hotel called the Vineyard at Stock Cross, and I was working there under a chef. I was the head chef, but there was an executive chef, and it was pretty cushy, no problem, straightforward, you know, paid well. And I was like, it wasn't fulfilling me. At 23 years old, which I was then, I was like running a kitchen with 20 people, and it was just like, you know, I shouldn't be walking around with a clipboard, I should be cooking. So I just completely went away from that and then opened the Black Pig. And yeah, so, and that was just crazy. because we opened on the 20th of May 2003. Can I remember it? My son was born on the 6th of May 2003.
and when did you get the Michelin star?
So we opened in the May 2003, so January 2004, because Michelin was came out in January now it comes out in October, and they changed it. But yeah, no, and it was not on the agenda. It wasn't even in. Yeah, my focus on a day there, because I was on my own in the kitchen for the beginning and I only had one chef, was just to get through the day. Yeah, it was literally, I need to make this work, because I was paying myself, I think, £13,000 a year. We were living above someone's house with a newborn baby. Wife's 23, I'm 25 at that point. I got to 25. So, and I'm like, I didn't for a second think, like, you know, what are we doing? I just went for it.
And you said before that you were running that kitchen on a shoestring with empty milk cartons as containers.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't afford any. I mean, I was lucky. My dad acquired or borrowed a few things along the way in his career working as a chef. And I borrowed them back from his garage and in Kent. I thought he must have come home. Where's all the stuff gone from the garage? And I had a few pots and pans, but mainly it was, like, if I wanted a non-stick pan, I had to go and get one of those £5 ones from Tesco's or whatever, you know. And my pans, say my containers, were all, you know, plastic milk cartons cut off at the bottom to create like a little pot. It was just.
And did you have any idea that the Michelin Guide were looking at your restaurant?
No. I mean, are they? I'd done a few competitions when I was younger, so the only way I can put it down to, if I think about it now, would have been that there was a little bit of exposure when you were competing as a young chef in these competitions. So, like, there's industry magazines like the Caterer magazine. Restaurant magazine wasn't around then. It was just Caterer magazine. And I think they must scale all the media stuff and everything and just look out for what's going on. And that's because I certainly didn't contact them or tell them that I was open, because I did. Yeah, I was like, the least on my mind, I just wanted to make this restaurant work. So no, it was nice. And they didn't, I think I got to speak to an inspector, and it was really, it was a very funny meeting. They just wanted to know the days I was open, you know, how long I'd been here, all this sort of stuff. And I think they must have known it all anyway. It's just like standard questions that they ask. And then the Michelin Guide came out in the January, and it was, yeah, one star.
And did that change things? I mean, did that suddenly create more interest?
It changed from an industry point of view. Yeah, okay, it got me a bit of attention. So people are like, who's this guy, you know, getting a Michelin star in 8 months of opening so quickly in like a remote part of Cornwall? Well, you know, it's not remote rock, but it's sort of like a bit out. In terms of business, it didn't make a massive difference, because we're a seasonal place and most people are like, well, what's Michelin? Yeah, most people are like, well, what is that? Yeah, it's, and I think it's still to this day, I think, unless you know about restaurants and stuff like that, you'll know about it, but most people don't. Yeah, so it was a great award from a personal point of view, from my sort of reputation. But in terms of business, we still had to battle on and try and just make it successful, because sometimes the Michelin star can make it not accessible and make people like go, whoa, it's posh, we're not going to go there. And that's a problem when you're, especially if you're in a seasonal location. And yeah, we've recently, with the fish kitchen that we've got, the little restaurant in Port Isaac, that's got one Michelin star. I don't advertise that at all.
Really?
It's probably the worst thing I could do, because it's because of the actual way the restaurant is, it's much more down to earth, and I want people just to come through there and eat fresh seafood and just go away happy. I don't want them to think about it. I don't want them to have to go, oh, it's, yeah.
And so, how does life in Port Isaac compare to Padstow? I mean, is it a kind of different fishing community?
Oh yeah. Yeah, they're very close by, but they're very different. Padstow's slightly bigger. And Padstow is a port where you've got a lot of, you can actually get away from the weather. So what I mean is that a lot of the boats will come in there if the seas are rough, including the Port Isaac boats. In the winter, they'll when they stop fishing for crab and lobster, they'll bring their boats into Padstow just for a bit of sort of calmness. But yeah, it's each one of those little ports around Cornwall, I suppose, all around the country have got their own ways. Yeah, so yeah, it's a little bit of competition, which is quite healthy and nice. And it's good for customers, because there's so many good restaurants in that area now, which wasn't always the case. Like when I first went down there, it was a seafood restaurant and then lots of imitations, good and bad. So yeah, whereas now you've got lots of different places.
And what about when you're out of the restaurant? What do you cook at home when it's just you and your family?
Well, I'm lucky. My children do like to, yeah, they like eating and they're quite good with eating. So we sort of have a varied thing. But I mean, my favourite food eating out is Asian food generally. I mean, and I think that comes from working with Rick. I think being exposed to those ingredients when I was cooking, I just thought that he just want to eat more of it all the time, which is great. And I think we, as at home cooking, it's much of homely things, you know, so, you know, shepherd's pies and toad in the holes and stews and things like that, you know, just things that are, you know, you can just put in the pot in the oven and then go and do your other things. Because the last thing I want to be doing on my day off is spending the whole days in the kitchen.
Standing over a stove, yeah.
I mean, I do enjoy cooking. My daughter wants to be a chef and... yeah, I'm sort of at that stage where I'm trying to talk her out of it, but at the same time trying to keep her, you know, knowing what's going on. And
what does she like cooking?
She loves baking. She's, unfortunately for it, she's like developed a gluten and lactose free problem, you know, dietary problem, intolerances. Yeah, so she started baking and actually quite successfully baking things with those ingredients taken away, and she's come up with some really good stuff. So she's carving, she could be carving a little sort of niche for herself, but I had her in the kitchen. So she's 14 now, and I had her in last summer holidays in the kitchen for the whole summer, and she loved it. Yeah, so I don't know. I'll just let her make her own mind up, I think, yeah. Because she's going to have a lot of pressure with surname and stuff like that that she's got. Yeah. Yeah, so it's not easy. So I said to her, you've got to be really into it. But yeah, I mean, I want both of my children just to be children and just enjoy the being, and there's no rush. Like, so one thing, you'll have plenty of time to work and do that when you're older. I think it's important that they just sort of have a bit of, you know, being a child time. Yeah.
And obviously you'd experienced having your dad as your boss when you were younger. What was it like when the dynamic was reversed? How did it feel having your dad as well, but also your daughter in your kitchen?
I love it.
Did you tell her off?
No, yeah, I did, yeah. No, she's a couple of them. She's pretty good. She's very much like me, so she's methodical in the way she goes about what she's doing. And she keeps her mouth shut when she's like in that environment. She talks a lot when she's not in that environment, but she just gets focused onto it. She's pretty good. But when I was working with my dad, I was the same thing. I just got my head down and did what he told me to do. And every time I got to an exciting, what I thought I was going to do an exciting job, like doing the service, he'd be like, right, washing up. And I'm like, oh. Yeah, so.
And how, so you've obviously run restaurants in Cornwall, in London, and abroad in Dubai. And how do you, sort of the attitudes to cooking compare in those three different places?
There's no doubt about it. In Cornwall, you've probably got a good 95% to 99% of the people are just there to enjoy themselves and relax, which makes cooking for people in that frame of mind quite straightforward. Whereas with London and Dubai, you've got... you just don't know who's going to be in the restaurant. It can be anybody, rich, poor, different religions, different cultures, different backgrounds, which makes running a seafood restaurant a bit more tricky, you know, because you've got to think about that. I mean, the toughest thing about running, what I learned from having the restaurant at the Capital, I was there for nearly 7 years, was I just was very naive when I started it, and I thought I could just get away with doing the stuff I was doing in Cornwall. No, I couldn't. I found out that very, very quickly.
What did you have to change?
I think the romance of eating, say, something like as simple as a crab salad in while you're looking at the seaside, and it's very nice, a glass of wine, it's very lovely, and everybody loves, you know, you can get that. You try and transfer that mindset into a place in London or in Dubai, it doesn't work. Because you've got to, there's more emphasis on maybe glamouring the dish up, like making, maybe putting a little bit more, not effort, because you put effort into a crab salad. I mean, if you're doing that properly,
it's the other, it up.
You've got to think a bit more about how it looks maybe, and then maybe, yeah, I hate to add more, I never add more elements, but yeah, if you have to in that aspect, you do. And some dishes are just too simple to work in that environment. So I found out that quite quickly, was told that. Yeah.
And what about reviews? I read some of the worst review you said you ever got was Giles Corran at Outlaws, and he was dining with Andrew Lloyd Webber. What did he say, and how important are reviews to your work?
Well, from a point of view of, like, because I'm not really worried about what people think about me personally, I don't really care. I'm not that worried. What I do worry about is when people sort of like hit either the staff that work with me or the, even the customers that eat with us and enjoy it. Yeah, I sort of fight, take offence to that. So I think that evening, I mean, with them guys on that review you're talking about, it's quite clearly that they'd already made their minds up before they even was eating what they were going to do. Factually, you know, the actual review was wrong, yeah. This is like 7 years ago. No, I'm still bitter. But it's sort of like it was just things on there that they said they ate things and it wasn't even on the dishes. And I'm like, oh, this is just a bit. Yeah, you can't come back. There's no way you can come back at that. You can't, because makes you look, you know, bitter and stuff. So you just got to just brush it off. And now I've got more and more sort of, I suppose, experience in being a restaurateur and chef and stuff. I just am quite focused on. Yeah, if we do the best we can, that's all we can do. And I truly believe that. Yeah, and I think, yeah, people sort of worry about with restaurants, you know, obviously the money side of it, you've got to make money to make it work. But that's the boring stuff. Look after the customers, look after your staff, and then really just continue to organically grow and get better at what you do as a product. You haven't got to worry about the money. And I'm a firm believer in that.
And you say looking after the staff. Would it be fair to say you run quite a calm kitchen?
Yeah. No, I don't. I learned very early working in kitchens where there were lots of, you know, high octane sort of like lots of, you know, things going on that you. That's not me. And I think it's. My mum told me when I was younger, I'm a big lad. She said, if you start throwing your weight around, you're going to do some damage. And I was like, it's always stuck in my head. So I've never been that sort of person. So I found it very. I suppose immature in a way when I was under chefs that were just throwing their weight around and being idiots. And I thought,
do you think that's changed? I mean, I suppose there was that period where there were lots of kind of celebrity chefs who were making their name through that. I mean, is that era slightly over now?
I think that you've got more kitchens where that's not happening anymore, but there's still a little bit of it there. And I just put it down to people just either being a psychopath for starters, right? Just because that's the way their mind is, or they're just really unorganized and the pressure's there. And that can come from anything. Yeah, they could be working in a situation where they're under pressure financially or they're under pressure from the standards point of view because they don't know enough. And it might be because they've been put in the wrong position, in the wrong place. But I've got no room for that sort of thing. You can't grow in that. People can't grow in that environment.
Do you think there's pressure on chefs nowadays to sort of become celebrities and to sort of have a presence on social media and that side of things?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, I mean, I do my own sort of Instagram. I deleted Facebook and Twitter because I just couldn't keep up physically with all the different things. And I just thought that, for me, Twitter was like very opinionated. And then Facebook, I just didn't want to look at any more babies that other people have had. And I was like, yeah, you know what I mean? It's just like a lot of noise. And I just thought, the Instagram one I sort of get because you do a picture and you put it up there and it's nice. And then I just kept that. I do that myself. I've got no one else doing that. So if it's spelling mistakes or if it's like the picture's a bit weird, that's my fault. No one else's. I'm not going to blame anyone else for it. So, but it's part and parcel of, like, especially opening restaurants now, right now, as we're talking about, it's a big part of people of their sort of like concept of what they're doing. I don't like that. I mean, we're not doing that here at De Goring. It's sort of like organically going to grow. We sort of made that pretty clear, like that's the way we do it. There's no getting away from it, though. It's part of society now, like that
and
sort of thing.
At De Goring here, your dad, am I right in saying, is going to be working?
Yeah, he's got a new title. Ooh. Chef Gardener.
So
now he is not only cooking, but he's also going to be looking after the gardens with the head gardener, and from a culinary point of view, so we can have some sort of things that are grown here that are going to be have an influence on the menu, which is going to be nice. Because the menu we're going to do here is going to be sort of split 50-50 into 50% sort of composed dishes, like the dishes that for your Instagram people are going to take a picture. Oh, in there, that dish, that sort of thing. That's part of it now. But the other part of it is going to be complete ad off the cuff. Like completely, we don't know. I don't know yet what it's going to be. So we're going to be completely led by what my fishermen in Cornwall or the guests. We're going to have guest fish as well that comes from, say, Ireland or Scotland or even from the Mediterranean if it's good enough. But that won't be on the main menu. Main menu's focus is Cornwall and, yeah, what we do in Restaurant Nathan Outlaw and the fish kitchen. So, yeah, it'd be good. But Dad's going to get some stuff. He's a really good gardener. Yeah, things like his tomatoes are just like the best thing you ever taste. And if we can get those on the menu, and then he has, like, anybody that knows has got an allotment towards the end of your sort of like year, you've got just loads of things like courgettes and stuff. Yeah, and he can make stuff out of that, and we can utilize that, so which is really, it's really cool and something unique that no one else has really done. So,
and looking in your new book, Restaurant Nathan Outlaw, there are, alongside the fish dishes, quite a few nostalgic based puddings. So there's one that's based around an Arctic roll,
yeah,
and there are custard creams. Do you have a sweet tooth?
Well, this is a podcast, so you can't see me, but you can probably tell by my physique that I do like a pudding. Yeah.
And do you particularly enjoy ones that sort of hark back to childhood memories?
Yeah, I think puddings and desserts, it triggers something in your mind that you just remember as a kid. I mean, you know, Arctic roll was always something that we would have for special occasions, if it was your birthday or it was something celebrating. Yeah, and it's great. And then all them sort of things. I was just brought up with a lot of baking. And my nan was we always go over there and she would make something, or my mum would be baking something. Yeah, so I've got a sweet tooth.
Do you have a favourite pudding? If you had to choose one.
Trifle.
Really? Well, there's a trifle in there.
It's healthy, isn't it? It's got fruit in it.
It's extremely healthy, yeah.
I also read somewhere that your daughter, Jessica, won the amateur sticky toffee pudding championship Padstow. Are you allowed to reveal her recipe for that?
Oh, well, I couldn't reveal the recipe, but I can tell you what it was. She was off on one of those days at school when you it's a teacher training day, and she's only like, I think she was 9 or 10 at the time, and I said to her, there's this thing going over in Padstow with some of the local chefs, and she said, well, I like to do that. And I said, go on and make it. And I, honest truth, the only thing I did was took it out of the oven for her. She made everything. So she got this recipe. She even tweaked the recipe a bit. She put like a little touch of dark chocolate in the sauce, which is not traditional to stick it up pudding for all them people out there that know how it should be done. And she made it, and it went into a blind tasting. So they couldn't have possibly known that it was my daughter, and they couldn't have, there's no way. She put it in, and she won it.
That's
amazing. And then it was very good. And there was all these like ladies from the WI, and there was these like things they really put out by this 10-year-old girl. And they were like, obviously they just thought I'd made it. And I was like, I swear to this day, I didn't. I took it out of the oven for her because she couldn't reach the oven because the oven's like up high. But yeah, no, she made that. And then we used that recipe when we opened at the Capitol. We had it on there for a bit. And then in Dubai, we actually made it the signature dessert in Dubai. And because it has dates in it, so the Arabic community loved it. They're like, sticky toffee pudding, it's so sweet, we love it. Yeah, they love really sweet things. So yeah, she, ever since then, she's been interested in baking, so it's good. But it's not in this book. It was in, before this book, I did a book called Home Kitchen, and I put that recipe in there. So yeah, so
but we have a trifle in this one, so there's something there.
It says the rhubarb trifle in it, so they're still good. Yeah, now the trifle is good enough for breakfast. I think it's like
definitely breakfast cake.
It is, isn't it? It's got everything in it. I get it. It's got cream and it's got fruit, so therefore it could be a breakfast. It could be a breakfast thing.
You're gonna have to start a breakfast menu now.
So, yeah, breakfast trifle club. That'd be great.
I would be the first member.
In that.
I'm there.
Nathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh no, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Nathan's new book, Restaurant Nathan Outlaw, is out now.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.